Welcome to Talking Jimmy Stewart, the podcast where we talk to people who knew Mr. Stewart or were influenced by his life and career. This episode's guest knew him very well because she's one of his daughters, Judy Stewart, and she helped name this podcast. We sat down with Judy inside a hotel conference room before the 2015 Harvey Award from the Jimmy Stewart Museum. So once again, you'll hear a little bit of commotion outside during the first part of the interview. But let me set this up for you a bit better. I had met Judy and Kelly at the Harvey Award ceremony honoring Carol Burnett, where I talked briefly with all three of them. The next year, I invited along one of my oldest friends, Michael Hutton, who had put visiting the Jimmy Stewart Museum on his bucket list. Michael and I had a fun time traveling to Indiana, Pennsylvania, and interviewing Jim Caviezel and then Judy. What we didn't expect was to get to spend almost an entire Saturday with Judy. It started with lunch, and then we got to walk through every part of the museum with her and hear story after story about her parents, her sister Kelly, and brothers Michael and Ron, as well as her sons. Afterwards, we even drove her in our rental car back to the hotel. We had a lot of laughs and felt like we became good friends with a very warm and engaging person. The only bad part was the realization afterwards that we probably should have been recording everything. Through the course of the day, so much of what I had planned to talk to Judy about for the podcast came out in natural conversation. So when it came time to record, well, we retreaded a lot of it anyway, and we got some wonderful insights into her family and home life. Enjoy.
Well, Dad, we used to call Dad the urban legend, because we've always felt he was everyone's dad, not just ours. But Dad was one of the silliest, wonderful people to have as father. Once Mom, in the dining room, decided to get one of those round tables that you spin, but she wouldn't get it till Kelly and I, my twin sister Kelly, were old enough to actually not go whee. So finally, we were age 14, Mom felt that that was okay. So we got this, and it was so much fun. It was Lazy Susan, that was the name of it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right, so it was able to move, and you can, you know, get the marmalade or whatever it was you needed. And so one night, Mom had just redecorated the breakfast room, and we were having lamb with this plum and mint sauce. But it wasn't us who turned the table. I saw Dad's eye sort of glint, and he just sort of, I saw him go, just move the table slightly, and then he spun that little mother, and oh my God, the thing flew off right onto the wall and just dripped down the wall. And Mom said, oh, Jimmy. It wasn't us she had to worry about. It was Dad. So he was silly like that. Made us laugh so hard.
And the tone that she has endured that over and over, just the way she says that, oh, Jimmy, something
you
do.
The fact that he would tell a joke and it would go on for 20 minutes when it was a 5-minute joke, and Mom would say, today, honey.
So you shared with us earlier about like a bedtime ritual, which I was fascinated by.
We loved Dad coming in, which wasn't often. You see, Dad was gone a lot. In those days, they were on set for 3 months. It wasn't like today. I mean, they were gone for a long time. And Mom would often go with them. We were brought up by this French-Canadian governess, if you can imagine that. Okay. Anyway, so Dad used to come in, though, when he was home. And he had this story that he started, and it was about this giant tarantula on this island called Ping Pong Boy. And I don't know how he
came up with it. The tarantula's name is Ping Pong Boy.
Ping Pong Boy. And he would start with, there were holes in the beach, unlike footprints, just holes. And they couldn't figure out what it was. Good night, girls. And then he would come back like 3 days later and say, but the holes led to something. It would go on and on, and we loved it so much.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
So he was a little Andre.
Oh, yeah. He also played, he also did this thing with us called Krabby, where he would put us on his lap and go, pinch, Krabby. And we loved, oh, my God, we just adored it. Probably had bruises all over our bodies.
Send you both into giggling fits.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Dad was very silly.
Not surprising.
Really, yes, really silly. But he could be, you know, very serious. He was very quiet. He was often rehearsing his lines. You didn't disturb him then, because I could see his, when he was moving his lips, you didn't go and interrupt him. That was him memorizing something.
Well, he took that very seriously, and other actors noted that he was always prepared.
Yep. Well, you know, when he Dad was very, very, very wonderful with new people who or younger people who were coming in. And one of the things when he started losing his hearing, he would not ever tell the other person to speak up, because he said Marlon Brando started the whole thing. He never moved his lips, and Dad red lips when he started losing his hearing. So one of the chances was to start talking like this, and you just don't move your lips. Right. And, you know, it's sort of like you can't read lips. So
Dad,
you know, it was, and he could, you can't tell the actor to speak up. You know, that just doesn't work. So this is...
That's how they compensate.
He said actors don't die. Actors don't retire, they die. And, you know, loss of hearing to Dad was a type of death. Like when he just couldn't hear at all. Mm.
How did that hearing loss begin? Because I was surprised to learn that a lot of that came from It's a Wonderful Life and that dive into the water. Somebody said that actually...
It was the war. Those guns. I mean, in those bomber planes. But I have it. I'm losing, well, as you could tell, losing my hearing. And I have terrible tinnitus, which Dad had. Mm. So it is genetic. And Mike has it too, my brother.
Does he?
Even though he's mom's son, not Dad's, he still has tinnitus.
Oh, unfortunate.
Oh, I know. You know what I hear? When it rains, I hear opera.
Really?
At least I hear opera. But it's an opera I've never heard before.
Wow.
That's fascinating.
You know, write music.
Yeah.
Isn't that weird?
You're a family of animal lovers.
Yes.
Dogs are associated with your dad because of the
Absolutely.
Poem Bow.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Many people know about that. There was an actual bow.
Mm-hmm.
Right. What time frame was that?
This was in the 80s.
Okay.
Yeah. When Bow was, and Dad, I don't know what it was. You know, that dog, he was 6 months old. Now, it was before the 80s, when he was a puppy. You know, '80s, he was older. When he was a puppy, it was the 70s. And I remember trying to take an avocado out of his mouth when he was 6 months old, and he attacked me. And I said, Dad, there's something. I mean, golden retrievers don't do this. And Dad said, I'll take care of it. Well, Bo became his favorite dog. And he had scars all over his hand from, you know, playing with Bo in the bedroom. But his poem... it was about a lot of things, yeah, more than Bo. But he adored that dog, just adored that dog. Because the dog would take, once a dog from across the street, this is fascinating. We had a gate, and it had about a 3-inch opening, one of those black gates, you know, decorative. And the dogs would stick their nose through. And, you know, one day, the dog from across the street, which was like a husky mix, came across and grabbed Bo's nose and ripped it.
Whoa.
He had to go to the vet. So Mom and I watched from actually my brother's window, which got the best views, Dad walking across the street to have a little talk with the people who owned the dog. And Mom said, just watching Dad's back was terrifying. Mom said, I wouldn't like to be those people right now. He was, you know, Dad was amazing in his slight body movements. He never moved his hands. You notice in movies, he never, very rarely moved his hand. Like people flapped their hands. He didn't do that. He never moved his hand. And he would stand very still when he was saying something. He didn't have to move, you know, to, and his, but his back would change. I remember going to see Ron's name on the Vietnam Memorial.
Mm-hmm.
And Mom wouldn't go. My sister said she went and didn't. She said, "Don't worry, Judy, you'll be fine. It's not that big a deal." But I watched Dad's whole body changed as he walked towards the wall. And I have never had a reaction like that. I mean, I've lost it. And for we were there for 4 days in Washington, and Mom kept sending me back to the room because I kept losing it. I've never been that devastated. Dad touched Ron's name and then just left me, and or just stood there and let me, you know, and it was, but Dad's body folded as he walked towards and got smaller with grief, and it just, it killed me. Saddest thing I've ever seen.
And he visited regularly.
He did.
Once a year?
He adored Ron, and Ron adored him and just wanted to be a hero. That's why he joined the Marines. He wanted Dad to look at him and say, "You're my hero." Ron was always my hero, but it wasn't enough. He wanted Dad to say, "You're my hero."
Hmm. What are some of your favorite memories about Ron?
Oh. Holding me over the fire in Africa and burning off the, you know, pockets on my blue jeans. Hitting me with a puppet when I wouldn't, you know, when I kept stopping his car on a racetrack. Oh, let's see, other thing. Ron was my, always my, from day one, I was always holding Ron's hand, sitting on Ron's lap, and Kelly was always sitting at Mike. So no one talked about it. It just happened.
Oh, wow.
Oh, I loved Ron. I loved Ron. And, you know, it's hard when you go from 4 to 3. You always feel like sort of like the third wheel a little bit, because the people who are the two, like Mike and Kelly, form a bond like Ron and I had. Ron died. It was, you know, I was the third wheel because I hadn't formed that bond that Kelly and Mike had. And it's hard to get back into the loop. Mm. It really is.
Right. Well, you talked a little bit about your home life, and I think a lot of people would be curious about how do you live day to day if your parents are gone for a long period of time? Because your mother would join your dad on set.
Oh, yeah.
You said it might be 3 months at a time.
Oh, yeah.
Did you see your parents a lot growing up, or how did that work?
Not really. They were, you know, my memories growing up are mostly of Mimzell, who was our governess.
Mm-hmm.
And Mimzell and I didn't get along. Kelly got along with Mimzell. For some reason, Mimzell and I just didn't hit it off. I don't know what. But I used to have terrible nightmares. And I remember having a nightmare that Mom and Dad were crucified when I was 7 years old.
Wow.
And Mimzell was walking between their crosses with two suitcases, and Mom was saying to me, who was behind Mimzell, saying, "It's not that bad, honey. It's not that bad." And I ended up with my head on the floor, my body on the bed, screaming for Mom. And then I came to and realized that Mom was way across the hallway, and I have to walk that dark hallway to get to her. So I sort of went, "Mimzell," even though I wanted Mom.
Hmm.
It was a tough dream.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Wow. Sorry, I don't That's know where scary. That came from.
Well, no, I'm curious though, was there any resentment not having your dad around, or your mom, or both?
No.
Okay.
No, I never, no, not at all.
And just something you were used to.
I think there might
be
with my brothers that they, you know, they were sort of, when we arrived, it was sort of the princesses had arrived.
Mm-hmm.
And they were sort of shuttled to military academy, and, you know, like Dad had gone, you know, Mercersburg, and my brothers hated it, you know, so, you know, it wasn't, except Ron went to of this place he loved, Orm Ranch, that because he was a cowboy from day one, and because we had this ranch in Nevada, and he was a cowboy. He was a hero cowboy. That's all I could say. Wow. So, but Mike, you know, really suffered at Mercersburg. He was it was a military academy, so you can imagine a conscientious objector at a military academy. It was not a good mix. Oh. But we, you know, were the precious one. And I think, I don't know how our brothers even loved us with that going on. Mike will talk about it with me. The princesses came along.
Yeah.
Oh.
So he'll say, but there's always a little edge behind the fun. And I think Ron, as I said, just wanted to be a hero to Dad.
Mm.
He was. You know, he was the biggest hero of all.
Mm. One of my favorite exhibits at the museum, and it was so great to walk through that with you today. And I was taken by just the joy you have, and you've seen it how many times, and it's as if you're seeing it for the first time. That was so much fun. But it's great to hear the love you obviously had for your parents and your brothers, and how that just kind of came through all day. It's just, it was great.
I could talk about it forever. Honestly, it was, our childhood was wonderful, really. When people ask me how it was growing up, it was great. The fact that they weren't there didn't affect us. If you go into some sort of philosophy, that it might have affected me more. Kelly, you know, that type of thing, because I was always the rebel, blah, blah. No, it doesn't matter in the end. They were great.
Would you say when they were there, they were really there?
They were wonderful. They were really there. They watched us do these plays until Mom finally said, dinner.
Yeah.
But we performed plays almost every night. We wrote them and directed them and were in them. And so they watched. They were wonderful. They were so patient with us. And Mom taught us to dance at our ranch, and she was wonderful. She was so bright and alive. And, you know, Dad was a little slower than Mom, and Mom was so vital.
I'm 10 years younger, so that was a part of it. She was 10 years younger than your dad. And what's amazing to me is your dad gets married at age 41, but then is married for 45 years.
Yeah.
I mean, that is amazing.
What's amazing to me is my son David, who looks exactly like Dad, has a girlfriend now who's 10 years younger than he is.
Wow.
She's 23, and she is so hot. But she's almost 6 feet. And David's 6'4", and she's just, we have so much fun together.
Oh, great.
But it's interesting that it sort of runs a family. When I married, my husband was 10 years older.
All right, so where I was going, I'm sorry, Michael, you're about to jump in with a question. All right, you'll follow me. One of my favorite exhibits was 918, and I just love seeing that side of your family.
I have a very funny story I just thought of. We used to get a lot of tourists that go in front of the house in 918.
Yeah.
And, I mean, some of them would come up to the door. One woman came up to the door once and rang the doorbell. My sister answered. She said, she was chewing gum. She said, "Hi, is Jimmy home?" And Kelly said, "Well, no, he's not." "Okay, can I come in and look around?" Kelly said, "Well, no." She said, "I understand. You like your privacy. Okay, well, tell Jimmy I came by." This woman had to be like all of 20. So. But we would get buses that would go by and have tons of people on them. The bus would lean. And in fact, one of our nannies, when we were very young, our first one, Wilson, who was bald, by the way, she would wheel us out to the street, and had a deal with the drivers that she would say, "Judy weighs so-and-so, Kelly weighs so-and-so, Judy's this tall," and Dad found out about it and fired Wilson. Then we got Mimzell. So anyway, Dad once, there was a family that arrived in a car, and they put a picnic thing out on the front lawn, and they all gathered around it, and they were having lunch, you know, just on our front lawn.
On your front lawn.
Unbelievable.
And Dad went behind the house and turned on the sprinklers. He didn't have to go out and say anything. It was pretty good.
I'm fascinated that you always lived in that house. A couple things. First, and you spoke a little bit about that, but like security would be way different today. You'd probably live in a gated community. And but what was it like day to day? I mean, did you have people just always ringing the doorbell?
We didn't even have a security system for years. It was just open door almost. And until one Christmas, and this was, years ago, so long ago, one Christmas, $25 was stolen off the table that they left for the mailman. This is how long ago it was. That's all you left for the mailman, okay? I forget who it was for, but... it was a little black boy who just grabbed it. I don't know how he got in or whatever. After that, Dad had this system put in that was just horrifying from someone like me who would creep outside. Woo, woo! And he would lock the door behind me when I went out to take the dog out, and I couldn't get back in. Particularly, it was difficult when they named the dogs Judy and Kelly, their last set of retrievers. So Dad would call, Judy! And I'd come racing from wherever I was, and Dad said, calling the dog.
Did they ask permission from you and your sister?
No,
what was
no,
that
no.
a... No, was no, there no, some no. statement he was trying to make by naming the dogs?
I didn't get to sleep in their bed. Like the dogs did, but that was about, a therapist once asked me, what do you feel about that? I said, why do you get to sleep in their bed? What do you mean, what do I feel about it? Bark? Do you want me to bark? But it was very funny. Dad locked the doors so much after that and had such a tight security system that when he died and all the photographers were outside, lined up and saying, we're sorry, we loved him, we're sorry. We were very gracious and stood in front, told him, what happened, what time and everything. Then Kelly, Mike, and I walked away very gracefully up to the house and stood there and tried the doorknob, and it was locked. And all of us went, God, Dad. So we had to ring the doorbell of our own house to get back in.
What was your question?
Well, we had talked in the car, and I said, would you call yourself a daddy's girl? And I really enjoyed your answers. I wanted you to bring that to us again in the interview.
Well, I think Kelly was the daddy's girl because Kelly was easier. But Kelly was the one who came up with all the ideas that I would carry out, and I would, of course, be, you did that, but it was Kelly's idea. But Kelly was... she always knew what she wanted. She was easy. She was a very, she knew what she wanted. She knew what Mom and Dad wanted. She just knew. And I was given a book when I was born that had empty pages, I'll tell you. And it's sort of like, find out on your own, honey. So I think it was more difficult. I was a very difficult growing up. Yeah. I had, sort of very difficult.
Hmm.
Still am.
Right, I think you have a minute. If we have any amount of time later, it'd be great just to...
Oh, yeah, I'm around. I'm not doing anything.
I'll ask one quick thing, though, real quick. All right. Okay, so who... Just about your house. All right, who made these statements? It looks like a dormitory.
I don't know. It didn't at all.
Okay, so I understand...
You mean our house growing up?
Right.
Oh, my God!
Yeah.
It had these rooms spread out all over the place.
All right, I understand.
Dormitories are lined up.
Your mother said that when they were house shopping, and your dad said, well, that's what we need, isn't it? And she
agreed. Oh, you sound like
agreed.
Dad. Oh,
I've been hearing you all day, and you do
that
the best.
Great.
You do the best
that
Jimmy
was really
impersonation.
Good.
Oh, well.
I don't say that lightly.
All right, who said, thank you very much. Who said this? All right, comfortable as Jimmy with a splash of style thrown in by Gloria.
Absolutely.
Who would have said that statement? And that's true, you're telling me.
Connie Wald, maybe? Of their very close friends.
Very close.
Yes. One of their very close friends.
Maybe one of Jimmy's oldest friends. One of your dad's oldest friends.
Gary Cooper?
It was Henry Fonda.
Hank
said that.
I was going to say that.
Right. Okay, and then belonging to a Mediterranean style of ugly.
Who would have said that?
I could give you a hint, but it'll totally give it away.
Give me a hint.
Belonging to a Mediterranean style of ugly. That was your father.
Oh. He really thought that?
My impersonation wasn't as good that time,
really
obviously. I think that sounded like a joking statement he would have made.
He said that about the house next door.
Oh, he did? Well, my research is poor.
Yeah, that's wrong. He said that about the house next door that he bought to rip down.
That sounds right.
It wasn't our house.
All right, good to know.
Yeah, it was the house next door that he ripped down and they put in a huge garden. He said, it looks like a Mediterranean nightmare or something to that effect. And guy who owned the house said about Dad's house, they're finally going to buy my house and rip that monstrosity down and move into mine. So it was so funny to hear the two.
Okay, at this point in the conversation, we were needing to get to the award presentation, so we arranged to meet up again. The next morning, Michael and I met with Judy around a coffee table in her hotel room, where she shared some family photos with us. Now, I figured without seeing the photos, that part might be kind of lost on you. But hang on after the closing music and you can hear a snippet from it. Here we go, picking up from the second part of our conversation with Judy.
My friend, Robin, who also works for me, my best friend, she's been at me for ages to put the book together. Mm-hmm. That's all I have to do is I've got all the poems. I just have to put them together.
Yeah.
And I do it like the way Dad did his book, which was the anecdote about why the poem was written. Like I wrote a poem about an empty chair, the lament of the empty chair, as an apology when I didn't make it to this event. And it was from the view of the chair. You know, come sit on me, we're so alone, you know, I'm so alone, and, you know, the man besides me so undone, you know, that type of thing. So I even wrote about a worm that attaches to goldfish heads, and it's this cool. horrible little thing that lies on the bottom of the tank and just waits for its opportunity, because it's a little bacteria, and it bores its way into... Indeed. And I wrote it from the view of the worm that does this. And it was just wonderful poem, my favorite, actually.
I think you have all the poems done, and you can illustrate.
Yes.
That's what holds a lot of people back is, you know, you have to collaborate. You've got it all.
Yeah, because I know exactly if I have the picture in my head of what would go along with each poem.
Yeah.
It's just sitting down for long enough to do it.
That's your next thing. And if we can help.
Maybe it's a matter of just getting it out.
Yeah,
you know?
or just a matter of talking to somebody and getting that encouragement and focus, because that's what holds me back.
Also,
you have the talent.
Encouragement and also the, you know, confidence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so it holds me back.
I've been struck by your talent this weekend.
Oh, thank you.
For sharing, you'll have to read some of those poems maybe for posterity here. You can hold on to them for a publication, but that might be.
So that would be, you know, the great is, you know, if I could get them all together typed.
Yeah.
You know, on my computer.
Yeah.
Because they're random right now. They're all
in all different places.
All right. Well, you might get
pretty much in one place.
Oh, really?
In folders. The folders are in a couple of different places, but it's pretty much along with my drawings and stuff in one place. So it's just taking that from, you know, the places on napkins and stuff where it's written to put it all together in a computer is what needs to be done.
I'm not getting encouraging email from one of us and saying,
yes,
right,
you
well,
have
today,
Mike.
You
yes. have
Mike. Michael has it, so I have to get it.
Okay, so earlier we were
talking about your house, and I wanted to pick up from there, and I heard a story. Well, first, I think you were quoted saying your parents
raising that house next door and putting a garden there was the best thing that they ever did.
Oh, by far.
And I understand they gave vegetables to neighbors.
Oh,
Jack Benny, Lucille Ball.
Yes, and Hank Fonda used to come to the house because he raised bees.
Yeah.
So he would bring over honey. And I remember listening to we'll call it a non-conversation between Hank and Dad. This is how they communicated. The doorbell rang. I answered the door. He said, "Jim home?" I said, "Just a minute." I got Dad. Dad said, "Hank." Hank said, "Jim." Dad had a handful of tomatoes, and they exchanged it. And Hank said, "Jim." And Dad said, "Hank." And we walked away.
What all wow. needs to be said.
There was a quote by Peter Fonda that said, "Once Dad and Hank were together in the garage building a model airplane for him, and he said it took about 3 hours to put together, and the only word that passed between them was, 'Jim, have you seen G11? You know, all yeah, the parts are the labeled.
Part, yeah, yeah.
That's it. For 3 hours.
Amazing.
And people, what? That's the best kind of friend, that you don't have to say anything. You can just enjoy each other's company, and there's not that need to fill in the silence.
No, I once asked Dad, "Gee, what happened, you know, to Hank's first wife, you know, Jane's mom, because she slashed her throat in the bathtub."
Oh.
And Dad said, "Oh, honey, we don't talk about things like that."
Yeah.
I wanted to say, "What do you talk about?"
G11.
Exactly. Right. Or once I asked him which actress was his favorite, and he said, "Oh, I got all dewy-eyed when he said, well, Marlena Dietrich was pretty amazing."
How neat.
Yeah, he did. He did get his eyes sort of got glistened, and you know, he really had a thing for her. I think she was, wasn't she in Dusty Rides Again?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, which was kind of a comeback for her, right? She had kind of gone away for a little bit or fallen out of favor or something.
And she was so dead, really. She was a beauty in his eyes. And
yeah.
He didn't talk about anybody else because he, you know, loved Mom so focused. Mom was so beautiful. I mean,
yeah,
it was hard to get dewy-eyed over, except for Marlena Dietrich.
Yeah.
And I guess he and Hank, when they first moved to Beverly Hills, this is how the story goes from Dad. They got very, very drunk one night and tried to dig a tunnel to underneath Greta Garbo's, when she was their neighbor, underneath her wall. And Dad said they got as far, which I find a little hard to believe, they got as far as the rhododendron bush, which was got in their way, and they gave up the digging. And Dad, Dad would say, "Well, you tell a story," and let's just say he made the facts a little more colorful than the story actually was. And Mom would say, "Oh, honey, that's not how it went." And Dad would say, "Oh, well, I like my version better." Must say, so did I. You know,
it kind of evolves over time.
Yeah. And, oh yeah, my fish that I caught, this catfish I caught in Africa, went from what it was, 25 pounds to in the hundreds. Last time I heard the story, it was 125 pounds we had to eat.
We've talked about a few things that dealt with your dad's thriftiness and like driving the same car forever, that kind of thing.
That Volvo.
Tweed jacket. That.
You know, he drove it until it actually, and it was still in the garage at his death. He drove that car till it actually stopped in the middle of the road, just gave up the ghost. And the police came and saved him. You know, we didn't have cell phones in those days, and police found him just sort of sitting in his car, took him back home. The Volvo sat in the garage forever. Wow. Never moved, never got fixed.
Just left it there. Sounds like he got attached to things.
Yes, he did, yeah. He, and like the tweed jacket.
Yeah.
in every photo.
Yeah. Which, a thrill of my life, getting to try that jacket on.
And you looked so good.
Yeah, that was amazing. Okay, earlier you talked about going to the Academy Awards with your dad. I think there's a picture of you and your sister from 1967.
Oh, wasn't that a charmer?
Beautiful. You both looked radiant.
Really? Yeah. Oh, I thought we looked like little chubettes.
Well, you're always hard on yourself.
Everybody goes through
what,
about
16? Yeah, that awkward.
That awkward stage where you haven't lost the baby fat yet, which as you can see, at 14, I didn't have.
Right.
And then we went away to Switzerland. Mom sent us away because we had a little clique in Westlake School for Girls. Dad called it the Westlake Mafia. And there were five of us, and we formed this little society, Scum. I was president, Kelly was vice president, and it was Secret Citizens United Missions. And we would do, well, as an example, this is my first exposure to anorexia. It was a girl in our class, and we didn't have a name then. And this is when we were like 12. And this girl went from being quite large to 68 pounds, and you know, and it was, you know, at that age, you just don't, you watch this, but you don't have a name for it, you don't understand it. But her parents put her on a diet, and she would have, you know, cottage cheese and tomatoes, and then she started getting thinner and thinner and thinner, and then her parents started, you know, making her sandwiches, and she'd throw away the sandwich when she got to school. We, thinking we were doing good, would retrieve the sandwich and put it in her desk. So she would arrive at her desk and open it and go, because she had thrown away the sandwich and it ended up back at her desk, and we're going in the corner. So this is, we thought that was a good thing.
Yeah.
United Missions for the city.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, this probably really freaked this poor girl out.
Oh, yeah.
It's all of a sudden the sandwich is back in again.
The exact opposite effect of haunting her.
But Dad loved our friends. But they were wild. Yeah. I mean, like, you know, the plum fight Tim and I had in the breakfast room that Mom had just redone. Never, ever seen Mom that angry. She was livid. Because she had just put white walls with these beautiful bamboo curtains, and they were completely plums. You know how what plums do?
Yeah. Well, how did this get started?
Tim and I got into an argument, and there was fruit on the table, but it happened to be plums on the top. So I grabbed the first thing and aimed it at Tim and hit the wall behind her when she ducked. And Tim picked one up and missed.
The purple mom.
Yeah.
Wow.
And Mom happened to come in, and she was so mad. Whoa.
All right. Family, friends of your parents, who stands out to you? Who did you enjoy being
with? Oh, let's see. Gregory Peck.
Yeah.
I adored. Once Mom, I had come back from Africa with a jet lag and was in bed upstairs, and Mom came home and came upstairs and said, "I know you're jet lagged, get out of bed and you got to come down. You can't miss this." So they were all a little buzzed, you know, having been out to dinner. And it was Gregory Peck, Mom, Dad, Frank Sinatra, and Hank Fonda. And they were all, and their wives, and they were all pretty, you know, happy. And all downstairs. And so it was wonderful. And I said to Frank Sinatra, I said, "Oh, you don't know, I only have one of your tapes, but we listened to it. It's now come on thread, but we had a recorder and I brought it to Africa, and we would play that tape every night, one of Frank Sinatra's albums." And the next day he sent me every single one of his tapes.
Wow.
Which I brought to Africa. Wow. But he was, you know, known for his generosity like that.
Yeah.
I said, "Are you guys really, really good friends?" Mom said, "Let me put it like this, honey. We're as good friends as you want to be with Frank." That's as much as I ever knew.
Yeah.
But it was quite a gathering. Gregory Peck was so wonderful. I was holding him. He started crying about his son who committed suicide. Oh. And I was sobbing in my arms. And I was like, wow, this is a moment I'm going to remember forever.
I can imagine.
It was incredible.
He was just able to open up to you.
He was that night, yeah. And I dated his son for a while, and he really wanted to picture us together because he really liked me.
Yeah.
And I adored him so much more than I liked his son.
Oh, yeah.
I was so not part of that crowd. It was... I was so awkward.
The Hollywood crowd and that.
Oh, and I'm wearing mom's, Jeffrey Bean outfit. I looked like some farm girl from Minnesota, this flashy crowd, and drinking martinis in these clubs that I'd never been to. I'd been living in Africa, and it was just, Dad never exposed us to that part of Hollywood, so I didn't know how to dress, I didn't know how to act.
Yeah.
I was very awkward. It was, and I was old enough not to be awkward. But I was like 21. I was so relieved when I went to Africa went to London with mom.
Yeah.
I think I was 22. And Dad spent a year there with Dad doing Harvey, and it was just great. I was safe. Mm-hmm. And I had, when I was there, I had been working the year before in Nepal. And at Tiger Top Jungle Lodge, and it was so great. I mean, it was so wonderful. And I met a lot of people who were like a duchess and an earl and, artists and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And they, who lived in London. So when I was in London, I was introducing, mom said, mom got such a kick of it. I was introducing them to Lady this and Lady that, like Lady Egremont, who's this wonderful lady who had this castle I used to go stay at. Butlers and talk about not knowing how to act well, but everything just so English. Everybody, dress up for breakfast. And I remember one evening there was a man there who owned a stomp airplane from the war that is open cockpit.
Okay.
And I think I had the extra glass of wine the night before, and I said, I love flying an open cockpit, never having done it before. I just love flying in open cockpits. So this is England, it's winter.
Yeah.
It's freezing. So at 6 o'clock the next morning, a knock is on my door, and he said, "Already?" So there I find myself in the front seat of an open cockpit airplane that he kept in the backyard. And so we took off from this green field over the fence, and then I find myself upside down as he did a loop. And I was holding the seatbelt that was, I was in front of him, and he was in back flying. The seatbelt came undone, the shoulder strap. And I grabbed it, and thinking that that's the only thing that was holding me in as I was upside down. And I was holding on so tightly that my hand froze in that position. And when we landed, he and another guy had to peel, because it was like paralyzed, he had to peel my hands off the seatbelt to get me out of the plane.
Wow.
And we landed the plane in the back of somebody's garden and somebody's house and went in for a champagne lunch. Just got out of the plane. It was amazing. That was an amazing year. Mom and I went to plays, and we would sit and talk, and it was just a great time with mom and dad.
And just you, which was unusual.
Yes,
yeah. You really had that experience. So you got to see your dad on stage in Harvey. You were telling us earlier just about that experience, like sitting in the back and watching the audience.
And watching the audience react, and you got a standing ovation every.
Oh, wow.
But it was an exhausting experience. Dad was in his 70s when he did that. And he did a performance every single night, twice on Wednesdays and Sundays, matinee, back to back. And he would go up those tiny little English stairs you have to sort of walk like a duck.
Mm-hmm.
But he just looked absolutely exhausted at the end of the day. It really took a lot out of him, because Dad never got over intense stage fright. Mm-hmm. And he would get sick before every performance, or, you know, almost to throwing up. So this is when I discovered that Mom had no idea what to do with the kitchen. Mm. Dad finally said to me, "Honey, can you get up and make my breakfast in the morning?" I love your mother, but she just doesn't really make eggs very well. So I guess since I wasn't up when Mom was giving Dad breakfast, I guess the eggs were a little burnt or so. So that's what my job was then, making Dad breakfast and his sandwich.
Yeah.
Also. So I made Dad a tuna sandwich, and I made myself one once, and I bit into it, and I guess there'd been a chip on the mayonnaise jar. And so when I bit into it, I nudged Dad, and blood was pouring out my mouth because there was a piece of glass in it. And I said, "Don't eat your sandwich." The devil's, I mean, it looked like a bus accident.
Everybody makes their tuna different, and some people put broken glass in there. Celery and apples.
I said, but a piece of glass, that was interesting. But ouch. Instead of Dad burst out laughing. frantic. I was going, I think that's it. So,
it's like a horror movie.
It was so much fun to, you know, to spend that amount of time. And then Mom and I once, part summer, we put Dad in the Connaught Hotel and took off for London. I mean, took off for Africa, sorry, mm-hmm. We were in London. And Mom and I went on safari together, and that was great fun. Mm. Just us.
Oh, yeah.
Really fun. Mm. That's when I discovered that Mom snored. So the first night we were out in the tent, and Mom would snore, I'd go to get her to roll over. Finally, 3 a.m, Mom said, "If you clear your throat one more time, I'm going to come over there and hit you." The next day, there was a tent for me and a tent for Mom. She had broken her back, so she slept on her back.
Oh, how did she break her back?
She fell, and I think she won't, you know, this guy, thinking it was funny, pulls her chair out from her at a dinner, and, you know, in other words, she sat down on the floor.
Yeah, just boom.
You know, just as a joke, it wasn't funny. It was one of those things that really, really was a disaster. I think that's when she heard it originally. And then she slipped or something on the stair, and I didn't see this, but this is what, I don't know, she wasn't in a cast or anything, but you say break a back, you know, that's just to get to the story. Yeah, so mm-hmm. I don't know if it was bulging disc or what, but she was, from then on, she, after the accident, she would sleep on her back and snore. Dad slept like I sleep, curled up, and he never moved from that position. Uh-huh. I thrashed, but I always go back to the curled up position, but Mom slept on her back. And you'd think Dad would be the one to snore because the guy usually does.
Yeah.
Mom. Nope. Beautiful, delicate mom. Sort of like a truck driver.
How did he maintain being kind of a small town guy in an uptown world?
He never moved from the town, I don't think, really, in his mind. Which sort of made him what he is. I read his diary, part of it from the war, and there was a particular story in there that really got me. And it was sort of depressing because he would have these drawings of his squadron in the war, mm-hmm. and then the next page would be X's over all the planes that didn't come back, mm-hmm. but no words, just the drawings. But you could just tell how he felt. It was just, I don't know, it was really sad to go through it. I mean, it would be like one thing, one return, you know, and so really that, Dad dreamt of the war a lot, and Mom said he would make sounds like machine guns and yelling and no, things like that in his sleep.
Yeah,
so the war really affected him. I think he felt prouder of the war than anything he did in films. that was his meaning. To him, acting was just a job. It was a job, and the fan part just came along with the job.
Right.
But the war was something he took great pride in, and more than his acting. He always thought, he never understood the fuss. I'm just doing my job, is what he'd say all the time to me. And I think part of it was it made his father proud of him, even though his father would not tell him, more than the acting, because he didn't believe in acting. He thought that wasn't a job, that was just nonsense that he'd grow out of when he got, he started out in architecture. Dad, you could build anything. And then he got introduced by Josh Logan to acting, and that was that. That's how it started, the club he was in Princeton.
Yeah.
And, from then, as they say, it's history. Just took over. But his father never acknowledged him acting.
Yeah.
I mean, when Dad won the Oscar, he put it in his window, hardware store window.
Yeah.
That's sort of only the only thing.
But didn't understand the significance of it, really. No. I understand he said, but I hear you won some kind of award.
Exactly. Yeah. And so, he made light of it. He just didn't make Dad feel that he was... And worth, and the story that I read in his diary really brought this. It was when he first joined the Air Force, and because he was already an actor, well known, and the brass, as they say, allowed him to take his parents out to Chasen's for dinner. So they gave him leave for where he was. Based when he first joined. And this, during the course of dinner, this man came up and said, wanted to meet Dad, shake his hand, and said, I thought you were in the Air Force. And his father said to him, yeah, Jim, I thought you were too. And Dad wrote, the shame I felt, and I never took advantage of doing that again. Now, the fact that Dad had taken his parents out because he thought they would love it, he did it as a gesture, and the fact that his father shamed him by saying that so intently broke my heart when I read it.
So
his father was like that.
Never gave his approval at all.
Yeah. It was wanting to live up to something that you couldn't. You couldn't live up to.
Was that difficult for him to make that decision to go ahead and pursue acting?
I'm
certain that would be really.
But it was such a passion of his, and then to find out that his father thought it was garbage was just. I really think it affected him all his life that he never felt good enough. I think that's what caused his depression later on. He never lived up to his father's. What his father never said, "I love you. I'm so proud of you, your acting career."
At the least, so many other people appreciate it. Somebody said the other day in a post online that he was given so much and he used it all so well. Your father.
Yeah.
But he never really felt he deserved it. All the accolades, I think it's based on the one person. He wanted all that from, wouldn't give it to him. That's just what I feel. I've always felt there was a sadness about Dad that, I drew a picture once of the family, and it was Mom laughing in the chair with the dogs around her. There was Kelly and Mike and Ron playing a board game. And there was Dad facing away, pouring everybody drinks at the bar. And I drew little sort of notations around him, like his shoulders were laughing, but you couldn't see his face. And it was sort of like Dad was there, but sometimes not. Because he was, his lips were always moving when he would go through the house, like he was memorizing lines.
Yeah.
So It was a presence, but not sometimes. And I just, you know, when Dad was just alone sometimes, I always just felt sad. It just made me sad when he was alone. I think that was just because there's a sense of that in Dad. Mm. That's why he gets to me so much in movies.
Yeah.
Even comedies. I mean, I find myself crying at, because there's just a touch there. Just.
Do you think that's what was behind his drive to be and was so successful?
I don't think Dad really expected to be this successful. You know, as I said, it was just, I mean, he really felt that. He wasn't pretend, he wasn't being humble for the sake of being humble. Even though Mom would joke and said sometimes he takes it a little far, like not getting a limo for the going to the Oscar party and driving his Volvo, and Mom's like,
yeah.
But you know, and I remember Mom, he was doing an interview and he said, when they asked what he did during the day when he wasn't working, Dad said, "Oh, I putter around the garden and, you know, take care of the vegetables." And Mom said, "He's never puttered in the garden the whole time I had it. It was always Mom out there." Yeah. Dad was in the library next to the fire.
Yeah. You talk about him kind of walking around and sort of muttering to himself. And I understand a lot of creative people are just introverted and they do that. They're content to be by themselves.
Yep.
So I wonder how much of that was sadness, or how much, you know, as you proposed, or he was just sort of in his own mind and just sort of walking around and not.
He was, I think, acting is a very private thing. I mean, you have to memorize your lines and be that.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
And it was so much Dad. His acting was not different. I mean, it wasn't like watching somebody change incredibly, become somebody else on screen. Dad never was a mean, horrible villain.
Right.
You know, so it was, I mean, he was what he was at home, too. Like the scene in Shenandoah on the Bridge, he was like that when I got the letter was sent home.
Yeah.
He was like the scene on the bridge with the guy, I want you to wait, I'm not going to kill you, but I want you to grow old and have sons of your own. And it was the bridge scene when Dad, you got mad at me for getting that, having that letter sent for riding cows, the farmer's cows, and stealing apples, you know, school sent.
Yeah. Is there a performance of his that just rings true to, that is Dad?
The scene in the bar in Harvey and the scene in the bar in It's a Wonderful Life, to me, the most wrenching, and the bridge scene in Shenandoah, the most wrenching performances I've ever seen. Mm. Probably because he's my father, but I do think they're one of the best in films. Mm. It's really, really just, they're so real. You know, it's just gut-wrenching to watch it when he... It's biting on his hand in the bar.
Yeah.
Just it gets you in the gut, you know, watching it. Mm. I just, you know, it's so vivid in my mind when I'm talking about it, it's sort of hard not to cry.
Mm. So I think Henry Fonda said that George Bailey is as close to Jimmy Stewart as you're going to see. Would you agree?
Yeah. And that's that scene, there's so much wrenching sadness in that scene in the bar.
Yeah.
You have to feel it's in the person. You know, you can't produce that out of thin air. It's not just acting. Yeah. It's there. So there, whether it was from the war, that sadness, whether it came from the war or something else deep inside, it was there.
When I watch back to It's a Wonderful Life, and I see him grab the kids and hug them and kiss them. And he set an example for me as a parent on how I want to treat my kids when I come home to them.
Real love.
Oh, wow.
And, you know,
such joy.
That part when he said before that scene, when he was so upset about not fulfilling some dream that, he, you know, moving away from the town.
Yeah.
And that scene where his daughter's playing the piano and he says, I saw that once with my son who was juggling in front of John, and he was juggling and everything. And this was, you know, Dad was quite elderly at that time. John was about 7 or 6, and he said, could you just stop that? And I remember the look of disappointment on John's face. It killed me.
Oh, yeah.
But it was the same, you know, I think Dad was very depressed then.
Yeah.
And it was the same exact feeling I got when he said that to the little daughter. I just started sobbing that part in the movie.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, even though that hadn't happened yet.
Yeah.
It always got me as a scene in the movie, and then I saw it repeated in life. You could sense Dad's frustration, yeah. Depression, that, you know, he wasn't acting anymore. And he said actors they don't quit, they die. They don't retire, they die.
Mm.
And that's what really, you know, Dad felt. I mean, and after Mom died, he just really gave up.
Mm.
He could have done so much, you know, coached acting, taught, you know, look at people who are, you know, 90, he wasn't, there was nothing wrong with Dad physically, except for mentally, he just was so depressed, he was never treated. You know, in those days, it was witch doctors, to go see a psychiatrist, and Dad's mom.
Yeah.
So he was never really treated, except by, you know, a family doctor, so.
Now, brief interruption here, and then we're almost done. Judy got a phone call at this point, so we paused for a moment. Here's the last part of our conversation where she was answering a question about who her dad was.
A combination of a hero because of the war, and a combination of a talented actor who people adored, and he was everybody's father. Yeah. We shared him with the world.
Yes.
Which is why we would call him the urban legend, because he wasn't just ours. I always got the sense that it was a gift that we had him, but a lot of other people thought of him as their father.
We heard a lot of that this weekend. People said that's why they were drawn to him. He reminded them of the best parts of their father or their grandfather.
Or what they wanted, that what they pictured father to be.
Yeah.
Or wanted their father to be, because it's an ideal. Dad was an ideal because he was so original. And it's original in your mind, like it's what fatherhood, a person is, an ideal of what a person is supposed to be. All of that wrapped into Dad.
Yeah,
he was loving
and it was
tough and kind.
But I never got the sense of something I had to live up to. All, you know, he never made me feel that.
Mm-hmm.
I felt it just because I, you know, lack of self-confidence. I mean, you know, because I didn't think I could acting. In other words, to go into acting, I didn't feel like I had the stuff in me to perform, to live up to Dad's type of performance. Not because he made me feel that. It's just the way I felt. Because he was just really, really, really good person, besides being a good father.
Was he a dad, because a lot of dads from that generation just didn't verbalize their feelings. Was he someone to say that he loved you?
Yes. He said, I love you all the time.
Your mother too?
Yes, and they were great huggers. I mean, when we got back from a trip from Africa or school or anything, huge hugs. Just real, all our family was really good huggers.
That's great.
Yes. Kelly's one of the best.
Is she?
That's great.
We hope to talk to her sometime.
Oh, you do.
Great. Thank you so much for taking time to talk to us.
Thank you. This was a really easy interview.
Yeah, it's been the best.
A really big thanks to Judy Stewart, who was incredibly gracious with her time, and again, a lot of fun. Now, a brief housekeeping note. I later found that reference about Jimmy possibly suffering hearing loss from diving in to save Clarence in It's a Wonderful Life, not to be confused with George Bailey losing his hearing, I know. But it's referenced in the book Jimmy Stewart, A Biography by Mark Elliott. I'm not buying it. I think Judy's right. The war definitely would have played a part in his hearing loss. Thank you for listening. As mentioned, stick around in a moment for a quick snippet which may include your new favorite Jimmy Stewart quote. I hope you'll plan your own visit to the Jimmy Stewart Museum soon. Keep a watch out at jimmy.org for the latest news and future podcast episodes. See you soon.
That was Bo, that picture of Bo. This is us with Dad. You know, Dad's, that's me, and that's Kelly playing the accordion. This is me taking pictures of a picture. Which is why, it's that's how I got these shots. Oh, here's Mom. Here's a really good picture of Mom. She was like that. She was so wonderful. I love that. That's Mom in Africa. Look at those legs. I mean, and Dad would say, I'm a leg man myself.